Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The midterm elections and Republican gains are still receiving wall-to-wall media coverage. Recent polls have shown that the number one issue for voters in this election is the economy. Headlines are focusing on the growing economy, lower unemployment, and record high stocks. But average earnings have not risen in more than 6 years, and the wealth gap continues to rise. So where are you seeing coverage that goes beyond the headlines, especially when it comes to the economy? Also, voter suppression and voter ID laws got a little more attention this year after Texas implemented the strictest voter ID law in the country. If you want news about voter ID laws and electronic voting machines, head over to the Brad blog, which is run by today's guest, Brad Friedman. Brad is an investigative journalist and broadcaster and host of Pacifica Radio's The Bradcast. He's a frequent contributor to Salon, Truth Out, and other outlets. Hi, Brad. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And on Wednesday, tens of thousands of people marched in Mexico City, mostly young people, over the disappearance of 43 students. What does the disappearance of these kids reveal about the collusion of the police and government officials with drug cartels and the perpetual violence in Mexico? Alfredo Cochardo is covering this for the Dallas Morning News, where he is the Mexico Bureau Chief, and he is author of Midnight in Mexico, a reporter's journal through a country's descent into darkness. Hi, Alfredo. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me back.
It's great to have you. I should say Alfredo is joining us from Ciudad Juarez. And I would like to welcome David Diane to the show. David has been writing about the economy and the election. David's contributing writer to Salon.com and a weekly columnist at the Fiscal Times. Hey, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday's Your Call Media Roundtable, we give praise to reporters who did a good job this week. So, David, let's start off with you. Where did you see good coverage this week?
Well, obviously the election was the paramount topic on people's minds. And I think that Harold Meyerson in the American Prospect really nailed what I was thinking about the election, in that the Democrats' failure to address coherently the problems that people are seeing in their economic lives really signaled the disaster that befell them, and that a new economic agenda rooted in speaking to this anxiety that people have with stagnant wages and soaring inequality and economic insecurity is really the antidote for Democrats to return to some measure of prominence. Mm.
Well, and you have an interesting piece today about Obama's advisors arguing that, basically arguing against Obama's policy, Christina Romer, who's left. And we'll talk about that later in the show. But I definitely want to talk about election coverage, because polls show that the number one issue for voters in this election is the economy. But, you know, headlines say that the economy is growing. We've got lower unemployment. So we'll definitely dig below the headlines. So kudos to Harold Meyerson. Thank you for that, David. And David Diane is a contributing writer to Salon. What about you, Brad? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm gonna drop in two items here because they come from sort of different sources. One is Greg Palast's report over at Al Jazeera about the return of Jim Crow, focusing in his case on millions of minority voters that are threatened by this new scheme that were threatened this past Tuesday by this new scheme put together by Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, this giant database that compares voter registrations in about 20 different GOP-controlled states to make sure that there aren't duplicate registrations. Problem is, the database matching system is incredibly flawed. It targets minorities, millions of minorities, many of whom may have been knocked off the rolls before Tuesday's elections, may have been challenged on Election Day because of this database, and may be knocked off the rolls in the future. That's one, and that's over at Al Jazeera. The
other one, and on that piece, yeah. Brad, just quickly, I've never heard of this interstate cross-check program. Where did this come from?
Well, it's by design that you haven't heard of it. It was developed by Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, who ran almost solely on the premise of stopping voter fraud. He's one of these GOP voter fraud fraudsters who likes to pretend that dead people are voting, non-citizens are voting, people are double voting in state after state. And so he's, you know, convinced his right-wing compatriots that this is going on. And he created this database quietly to cross-check, as it's called, to cross-check registrations between states. In some regard, it makes sense. You know, to do that. The problem is most of the people who are registered in several states at once are registered that way because they've moved. You know, they're not trying to vote twice. They've moved, and it takes time for them to be removed from the previous state that they were in. The problem is the scheme that they use to determine who is a double voter is completely flawed. They match people who don't even have the same middle name, for example. Mm. They tend to match people who have ethnic-sounding last names. So that's where it came from, and it's not transparent at all. It's, you know, sort of kept very secret between the Republican states.
Yeah, and this Al Jazeera piece found that black last names are overrepresented by 45%, Asian last names 31%, Hispanic 24%.
Correct. And I want to, if I can, toss out one other very quick piece of good work because it's by a blogger, and it's a blogger who goes by the name of Potato Head. Mm. So I think I need to report that Potato Head over at Daily Kos has done a tremendous job in an article called About Touchscreen Voting that explains exactly why touchscreen voting can never work, is antithetical to democracy, is 100% unverifiable. Because it simply doesn't reflect the intent of the voter. It's an electronic interpretation of the intent of the voter that may or may not be correct. We can never know, as opposed to a hand-marked paper ballot. And he also extends his really smart explanation of this to why it is that internet voting can never work, and why it is that having open source on computer tabulators and voting systems also fails for the same reason. So really smart work, and I, you know, blogger or not, named Potato Head or not, I need to cite those folks who are doing that kind of smart work. I wish there was more doing it in the mainstream corporate media.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely talk with you later in the show about electronic voting machines, which really got hardly any attention this time around. That is Brad Friedman, who runs the Brad blog. And what about you, Alfredo Corchado? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to go with Brad and also cite two examples. The websites in Mexico, web news sites in Mexico City, the one is called Animal Político, Political Animal, and the other one is Sin Embargo, which is roughly translated into However. And these two websites have done an incredible job over the last few weeks in keeping the pressure up on the Mexican government, asking questions and trying to investigate the disappearance of these students that we'll talk about later, the students in Guerrero. But I think it's worthy to note that in Mexico, anytime you try to investigate stories or anytime you do investigative journalism, it could lead to death threats. It could lead to, I mean, you're basically playing with your life. Mm. Mexico remains one of the most dangerous countries to practice journalism. Yet these two websites have really continued to keep the pressure on both the government in Guerrero and the federal government. And that, I think that's something worthy to recognize, especially away from Mexico. But I think the more attention you bring in the United States, these journalists need a lot of support from outside of Mexico. And the second one that I really enjoy watching this week, I'm on the border of U.S. Mexico, so I've been also exposed to a lot of the elections this week. And there was a web story by photojournalist Marco Ricci in the New York Times. It's a short documentary. It's about an 8-minute documentary profiling a Democratic candidate in Texas, Mike Minter, who's underfunded Democrats. But it's really kind of compelling look into the uphill battle for a Democrat trying to run in the very conservative district, and it's witty, it's funny, it's sad, but I think you walk away understanding just how difficult it'll be for Democrats to someday become a red state.
Hmm.
Or a blue state, I'm sorry.
A blue state. Well, thank you for that. That's Alfredo Corchado covering Mexico for the Dallas Morning News. He's their bureau chief and author of Midnight in Mexico. And we will put all of these links on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Alfredo, since you did bring up the election and talking about Texas, what are your thoughts on the voter ID law in Texas? Is this getting a lot of coverage in Texas? Because according to reports, this new voter ID law, the strictest in the country, had the potential to disenfranchise 600,000 voters, mostly poor voters and people of color.
Right. I mean, I don't cover the Texas politics. We have an Austin bureau. I'm more based out in Mexico City. But obviously, anytime you cover the border, I mean, those are some of the issues that you confront. And it's a huge, huge issue, especially with in the Hispanic community. You see a growing electorate, and yet there's always a way to try to marginalize them and keep them away from the polls. That was obviously a huge issue in this election. But talking to my colleagues in other parts of Texas, it was a clear attempt to try to keep this growing giant, you know, the so-called sleeping giant, from really having an impact in the U.S. electorate.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about what's happening in Mexico. Now, you are in Ciudad Juarez. Earlier, you talked about how difficult it is for journalists to report from Mexico, how dangerous it is. What is it like for you to go back and forth?
Well, I was born in Mexico. I'm a Mexican citizen, but I'm also a U.S. citizen. I mean, I have a U.S. passport, which I think gives me a lot more protection. You can't really compare an American journalist to a Mexican journalist. I mean, it's mm-hmm. very difficult for a Mexican journalist to do any kind of investigative journalism to really question. In my case, I go in and out of some of these more dangerous countries, especially along the northeastern part of Mexico, and always try to remind my sources or people around me that I'm a U.S. citizen, and I think that offers me protection that my colleagues in Mexico don't have. I mean, Mexico, unlike the Middle East, I mean, if you're dealing with an American journalist, it's more radioactive. It's not a political commodity, and so they try to generally keep, you know, stay away from you because it could mean consequences to the $40 billion illegal drug industry or so. I mean, some numbers have it bigger, some numbers have it smaller. But I'm constantly trying to remind people that you know, that I may look Mexican, I may be Mexican, but I actually have a U.S. passport, and I think that makes a huge, huge difference. Mm.
Give us a snapshot of what is happening with the disappearance of the 43 students. Tens of thousands of people marched in Mexico City on Wednesday, mostly young people. And then there were also young people protesting on September 26th. They were saying that education, the fees for education was going up and it was impossible for them to afford school. Police opened fire on those demonstrators, killing three students and three bystanders. And then in the aftermath, 43 students were disappeared. So can you give us a snapshot and a little bit of background on this?
Sure. I mean, it's been more than 40 days now since these students have disappeared. And I think more than anything, it's really has reawakened the country from the nightmare. I mean, I think you have a new president who came in 2 years ago who tried to change the narrative of the country, try to focus a lot more on economic reforms, whether it's telecom, whether it's energy. At a time, you know, I mean, he took office, more than 100,000 people had been killed or disappeared in Mexico. But I think the new president, Enrique Peña Nieto, was a master, has been a master about controlling the new narrative and trying to say, you know, Mexico is much more than that. Let's focus on this. I think Iguala, I mean, the Guerrero situation, the disappearance of these students, has reawakened the country. And has also pressured the government to not just, you know, that it's not really that easy to change the narrative. I mean, you have to deal with the questions of insecurity, of corruption, of the collusion between authorities and drug cartels. And I think there's a looming question in Mexico these days. I mean, yes, there's been all these protests, and it's it's really a nationwide strike, if you will, you know, where you have students in different parts of the country, including here in Ciudad Juarez, that are not going to classes or protesting. But it's also the looming question is, can you build a nation on quicksand? And can you build a nation with very weak institutions, with no rule of law? Can you really bring all these investors in, you know, whether it's for energy reform or telecommunication reform, when the impunity rate is still 95%? In other words, less than 5% of cases in Mexico are solved or even investigated. Those are the questions that I think Guerrero has awakened throughout society, and that's something that I think Peña Nieto is struggling with. I mean, this is clearly the biggest political crisis in his two-year term of administration.
Mexican journalist Anabel Hernandez has left Mexico because she was threatened, and she says that the president has been slow to respond to this crisis because his administration is implicated.
There are always a lot of allegations that of the ties between drug traffickers and government officials. I mean, those are some of the same allegations in the previous administrations. I don't doubt that at all. I mean, I think you can have a thriving criminal organizations without the complicit approval of elements of the government. I mean, how high does that go? I mean, that's a debate that goes on. I think Guerrero really demonstrated how the two sides really come together. I mean, you had a mayor, you had a wife who were implicitly tied into the drug traffickers in that state. The wife allegedly has relatives in this organization. The police who took these students were working for the cartels. I mean, I think this really exposes the level of corruption that exists, not just in Iguala and Guerrero, but I think throughout many parts of Mexico. I mean, I think if you look at Mexico, and one of the stories that we as journalists or human rights activists really have not done enough with this, is how many clandestine graves are there throughout the country? There are many, and Guerrero sort of begins to make people understand, you know, I mean, they found 23, and people say, oh, good, it's not the students, but yet who are they? There's something like 300 bodies in the state of Durango, more in the state of Nuevo León, in the state of Coahuila. I mean, you can just go on throughout the map and look at 31 states, and you can talk to people, and they'll point this to point that. But these states are still heavily, heavily controlled by organized crime, that it's difficult for journalists, whether it's a foreign journalist or a Mexican journalist or human rights activist, to really go in there and investigate.
Hmm. Al Jazeera America had a really good piece on the history of the school and how it was a way for poor rural Mexicans to send their kids to get an education. It also focused on how privatization is threatening the future of these public institutions that offer free education to poor children.
Exactly. I mean these students were basically trying to, you know, take buses so they can go protest. I mean, the only way out for a lot of these people, it's either you go to the United States and work, or you try to make something out of nothing in Mexico, and the only way to do that is through education. We're faced with this incredible tragedy, which is really, there's a poem by Octavio Paz many years ago that really resonates today in Mexico, and that's the shameful Mexico, the part that that shames the country. I think, you know, if you talk to people, I've been talking to protesters the last few days, one thing that comes out is at least this is getting out beyond the Mexican borders, because I think there was a time when the international investors and people just away from Mexico began to look at Mexico in a different way. And Mexico, I mean, there is an incredible potential. I mean, there is a more prosperous part of the country. But again, you can't really build a country with on quicksand.
That is Alfredo Corchado. He is covering this issue for the Dallas Morning News, where he's the Mexico bureau chief. He's author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. We're also joined by Brad Friedman. He runs the Brad blog, which focuses on voter suppression and electronic voting machines. And David Diane is a contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist at the Fiscal Times. And if you'd like to join us, We're going to be talking about Mexico for the next few minutes, and then we will talk about the elections. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And David, I wanted you to jump in here because this is not just a story about Mexico. This is also about the United States because of the close ties, the drug war, NAFTA. You write about trade policy. How do you think a story like this should be covered in the U.S.?
Well, first of all, it should be covered at all. I mean, I'm certainly learning quite a bit from your other guest about these issues, which really aren't brought to the attention of the American public, and we should talk about how and certainly the drug war, as you mentioned, plays a role, a significant role in the makeup in Mexico and the United States, but also trade policy, as you referenced. You know, since NAFTA is about 20 years old now, and we have seen what it has done, not just with factories in the United States leaving, but what it has done in Mexico in terms of producing situations that can potentially lead to more violence and more more of this kind of illicit activity because of the you know the ability for corporations to site their facilities in different places and just the rise of the cartels. So what I would say is that we certainly need more attention on these issues and on global trade policy generally, because in this age of globalization, it really is the case that what happens here does affect the entire world, and it matters that you're going to get policies that and particularly in terms of trade. I mean, because we kind of generally have this global society already kind of created and these linkages already there, any further developments in trade policy are inevitably along the lines of so-called smoothing or harmonizing regulatory policy, which ends up being really sort of a gift to large corporations to limit the ability for national governments to actually challenge them on things like labor, environmental policy, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So that's what I wrote about most recently, is that with the election, the fact that Republicans are going to take over the Senate makes it more likely for more corporate-written trade deals to come into prominence. And sadly, because we have so many trade deals already with these other member countries, and what that really means is loosening of regulation.
And David, hold that thought. We're going to talk about that right after the break. Alfredo, before we let you go, what are you working on right now on this story?
We're working on right now just looking at how these protests are spreading, not just throughout Mexico, but really throughout the world. I mean, there's been protests in France and Spain yesterday, in New York City and Cambridge. So we're trying to see, because, I mean, you see this happening every 2-3 years in Mexico where some big tragedy happens. This is obviously the biggest crisis we're paying yet, but really, will it lead to any real change? And that's we're trying to gauge that throughout the country.
Well, thank you so much, Alfredo. We will definitely have you back on to talk about this and your book. Alfredo Corchado is covering this for the Dallas Morning News. Thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back after this.
This is your call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To take part in today's conversation, the number is 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address, the inbox, is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Ferguson, the Bay Area and beyond, a conversation about race and justice. It's a special presentation from Inform coming up at 11, just 30 minutes away here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with Sheldon Krimsky, co-editor of the book The GMO Deception, What You Need to Know About the Food, Corporations, and Government Agencies Putting Our Families and Our Environment at Risk. We will talk about what's in store for the future of food labeling in light of the labeling measures going down in Colorado and Oregon. We will also talk about what happened in Maui, where voters there decided to ban GMOs from even being planted, and now Monsanto is fighting back. So we'll talk about what's happening on the GMO front on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're going to talk about coverage of the election, the economy, low voter turnout, and voter suppression. Where did you see solid coverage of these issues? I'm seeing so many headlines about how the economy's back, unemployment is low, record high stocks, but average earnings haven't risen in more than 6 years, and the wealth gap continues to rise. So where are you seeing solid coverage on these issues? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave an online comment at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Brad Friedman, who runs Brad Blog. If you want to know anything about voter ID laws and electronic voting machines, head over there. Brad is host of Pacifica Radio's The Bradcast, and we're joined by David Dayan. He is writing about the economy and the election for Salon.com and the Fiscal Times. And I wanted to ask you both just about the analysis that you've seen. It's been a couple days since the election, so many headlines, and yet I haven't really seen much attention about the fact that we hit record lows across the country, record low voter turnout, about 40% overall. In California, it was around 23-24%. I mean, these are really low numbers. How significant is this, Brad? And are you seeing much coverage of this?
Well, actually, one of the things that caught my eye yesterday was the fact that voter turnout in Texas and Georgia was really low, was in the high 20s, early 30%. Now, I know that was similar out here actually in California, but we didn't have a huge contested senator's race or governor's race the way Texas and Georgia did. Texas and Georgia happened to have very strict photo ID restrictions, so it caught my eye that their turnout was so incredibly low. But it's and I, you know, we can talk about those details in a minute and how that might have had an effect, but you know, turnout is usually an effect of voters having nothing to vote for. I hear a lot of people, I've seen a lot of people blaming the voters, blaming specifically young voters this time around. Well, you know what? If you don't give voters something to turn out for, they're not going to turn out. And, you know, hearing over and over again how awful the voters are, how lazy the voters are, I think the voters are voting by not showing up. That's a vote. Because they had nothing to vote for. You know, in 2008, they had something to vote for good or bad, they turned out. You know, and so for Democrats in particular to be surprised and disappointed in the low turnout, I think they should look at themselves rather than looking at the voters personally.
And the California numbers, only 22% of eligible voters and 30% of registered voters cast ballots. What's your read on that angle, David?
Well, one thing we do have to be careful with is there's probably a million ballots in California left to be counted. Late absentee ballots, provisional ballots, that could potentially raise that number by 3, 4, 5, even 6 points. I think in general, the media jumps on these turnout numbers a little bit early before all the votes are counted and makes it look worse than it is. So we have to be a little bit careful of that. The main narrative that you're talking about doesn't really change. I mean, there's not that much difference between 22 and 27, but we should try to be accurate there. What I would say is that Brad is in my view correct that Democrats basically ran a Seinfeldian campaign, kind of about nothing. Based on, you know, stop hitting me, I think was the main theme of the campaign for many, many national Democrats. that don't worry, I'm not like Obama. I'll run away from everything he stands for and everything the party stands for. Now put me in office. And that's just not going to work. And so a number of people did feel that they were kind of left without any options within this election, and it made it difficult, even though every election ends up having something at stake. The fact that the GOP took over the Senate, even though there's talk in D.C. that this won't matter, that gridlock will continue, no, there probably are some discrete issues that are pretty crucial to the electorate that are going to go forward as a result. And the same thing in the states, where it's probably even more pronounced. When a Sam Brownback wins, there's a number of destructive kinds of policies that can continue, and that was true up and down the line and throughout the breadth of gubernatorial elections that were decided.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My question concerns the disparity between the final polls in several Senate and governor races with the final vote totals. The governor races in Kansas and Wisconsin were too close to call, and then the final results had the Republican winning with 50%, and the same with the Senate races in Georgia and Kansas. So ever since Bush's final results were a lot higher than the polls in 2004, I've been kind of wondering, whenever a Republican wins after the polls show that the race is neck and neck, and so question is, am I paranoid?
Well, thank you. Brad actually has a story that touches on all of those issues. Brad, I mean, you've got some amazing numbers in here, and this is from the Brennan Center for Justice. So, for example, you quoted Wendy Weiser of the Brennan Center saying that we know from the Kansas Secretary of State that more than 24,000 Kansans tried to register this year, but the registrations were held in suspense because they failed to present the proof of citizenship now required by state law. I mean, that's just one example.
That is one example, and that was in a race that was purportedly won by the Republican Governor Sam Brownback by less than 33,000 votes. And your caller may be paranoid, but he's absolutely right to be paranoid. Trust in elections, frankly, has no place. It's about public oversight of what happened. And right now, particularly with the voting systems that we use, the electronic voting systems that we use, and the schemes that are run by folks like Kobach, Secretary of State Kobach in Kansas, it is impossible almost to oversee our results. And what we end up with is what your caller referred to and what I write about today, specifically at the top of bradblog.com in a response to Nate Silver, who said that the polls, it was the pre-election polls, he argues, that were skewed towards Democrats. And he makes that case by comparing the pre-election polling averages in the state, in the Senate and gubernatorial races, to the election results, to the unverified election results. And he sees that they were off across the board by about 5 or 6 points on average. He says that is a normal amount to be off. It's within the margin of error, if you will. And I accept that. But he points out that the difference this year was that they were all off in one direction. All of the election results that were reported ended up favoring Republicans, and he says, well, therefore, the pre-election polls were skewed towards Democrats. Now, mind you, the pre-election polls are done by dozens of different pollsters, all who have different methodologies, and essentially they all came up with the same thing, and then the election results come around, and they show something completely different. So I ask and point out a whole bunch of evidence, a whole bunch of concerns, things that Nate Silver doesn't look at all, the massive voter suppression, the dirty tricks, all sorts of things that happened on Election Day that he doesn't even look at. I would argue that it was not the polls that were necessarily wrong, but the results that were skewed to Republicans. And I make the case why, I won't go through all of it here, but there is always this presumption after an election like we saw on Tuesday, where you have the surprising results, where people presumed the results were right and the polling was wrong. We have such a horrible system of elections in this country, from the front end and people having access to the ballot box, the ballot booth at all, to the back end, where all of our votes are tabulated in secret on computers. So why presume that the polls are wrong rather than the election results are wrong? Nate Silver, who I otherwise admire, just, you know, makes this huge presumption, and I think it's inappropriate, and it's certainly premature, because we're still counting ballots and we're still hearing about all kinds of problems that voters had on Tuesday coming in from all over the nation. So the caller is absolutely right to be paranoid about it, and I wish the media would pay more attention to anomalous results like this, rather than chalking it up to, oh, the pollsters must have got it wrong.
So what are you saying exactly? I mean, where does this leave us? Is there specific data that takes a look at any sort of problems that may have happened?
Well, so far, there have been very few. I should actually say almost zero folks other than Bradblog.com who are sort of trying to aggregate all of these problems that occurred on Election Day. To say, hey, did this have an effect on the results? You really got to go digging out there. You'll find pieces. Wendy Weiser's piece was terrific at the Brennan Center, looking at four different states, key races, where the margin of voter suppression was potentially larger than the margin of victory in Texas, in North Carolina, in Kansas. I'll drop one more example. Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, we've mentioned him a few times here, big GOP voter fraud guy. Last week, he was tied in the polls with his Democratic challenger out there in Kansas. When the results came in, he won, reportedly, according to his own numbers at his own website, he won by 18 points. That should raise some eyebrows and some questions about, both the election results and access to the polls. But it seems that very few people are asking that question. They're just accepting the results and moving on to say, hey, who's going to win in 2016?
Well, David, you write about this, and the Brennan Center again says a quick look at the numbers show that in several key races, the margin of victory came very close to the likely margin of disenfranchisement.
Yeah, let me just agree with the thrust of Brad's reporting. I mean, it really is stunning, the presumption. I mean, that's really the key point, is that we talk about voting rights in this country intermittently in the lead up to an election. And then on election day, we stop. We just completely stop. And then we attribute voter decision making to narratives like soccer moms or security moms or things like that, and we never get back to talking about, well, yeah, there also was this tremendous amount of voter suppression that went on. One example that hasn't been mentioned is in Illinois, where apparently robocalls to election workers created delays in the city of Chicago for the polls to be open, which potentially disenfranchised thousands of voters who stood in line for hours and hours, and some left because they just, they have jobs to go to. They couldn't stick around. So, and that was an extremely close gubernatorial election that was eventually won by the Republican, and nobody knows who made these robocalls to the election workers to tell them not to show up at the proper time. So that's just an example, and this, the media completely ignores this after the election happens. They might talk about it a little bit with judicial rulings on whether voter ID laws can go through or whether this law can go through or that, but after an election, it becomes invisible. And one problem is it becomes invisible to politicians as well. And the politicians stop talking about this stuff. I mean, I remember in 2012, after the election, Obama said, we had people waiting in line for hours to vote. We got to fix that. That was in his acceptance speech after the election. And that was the last time, I think, that I've heard Barack Obama talk about voting rights in general or having to fix long lines at the polls, which are usually disproportionately in poor areas, with voters ain't more inclined to vote for Democrats. So it's a huge problem. It's a media problem, too.
Well, and then the Florida governor's race was decided by a 1.2% margin. Governor Rick Scott narrowly beat former Governor Charlie Crist by just under 72,000 votes.
I wanted to jump in here on that because, in Florida, you had electronic voter ID systems that went down in the Democratic stronghold of Broward County. That kept people from being able to cast their vote. Did that have an effect on the eventual results in that, you know, really close race? David also mentions what happened in Illinois. I want to underscore that because some 2,000 election judges, one-fifth of the workforce in Chicago, again, in the Democratic stronghold, didn't show up for work at all because of this robocall scheme. And then you had this, this contest in Illinois that where we thought the Democrat was going to win, according to the pre-election polls. The Republican ends up winning. In St. Louis, Missouri, in Ferguson, Missouri, paper ballots ran out across St. Louis County. One poll election supervisor said that when he showed up for work in the morning, where there is usually 300 of one particular type of ballot, paper ballot, there were 5 when the polls opened in the morning during morning rush hour. So they were, scrambling to print new ballots all day in St. Louis. They had to keep some of the polls open late for those people who could afford to either come back or stay in line.
And this
these things have an effect.
You're talking about Ferguson, and when we did a show last week about the fact that there was a major get-out-the-vote campaign after the killing of Michael Brown.
Well, that's right.
And so you're saying that paper ballots ran out in Ferguson? I haven't heard that anywhere.
Yeah, of course. Well, you got to read Brad blog more often. But the fact of the matter is, ballots ran out in Ferguson, where they knew there was going to be an increase in turnout. And mind you, they knew beforehand not only that there would be an increase, but that in previous years, about 20% of the voters would use paper ballots rather than touchscreens. You get your choice of either one in St. Louis County, my old hometown. They knew there would be about at least 20% of voters who would want paper ballots. They only supplied 15% or less. Why did they do that? Mm. These things seem to me to be important and should be covered in the media.
That is Brad Friedman. He runs the Brad blog, which focuses on voter suppression, voter ID laws, and electronic voting machines. We're also joined by David Dayan. He's been writing about the economy for Salon and the Fiscal Times. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Let's go next to Charlie in Berkeley. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning. You know, I wanted to talk about a specific proposition on the ballot in California, Prop 48. By way of disclosure, I worked for the campaign, and that both biases me but also actually gave me exposure to dozens and scores of articles written by the media in the state about it. And, Prop 48 was just interesting because it really dealt with just it was a tribal gaming issue, and it dealt with one small tribe in one small county and whether the agreement that they had with the state of California should be upheld or not. But as a broader policy issue, I think Prop 48 deserves some analysis after the fact because I think it provides a great cause for the evaluation of and reform of the proposition, the state initiative system.
Mm.
You know, it was a little thing that got blown into a big campaign by some local tribes that didn't want that other tribe to succeed. And just the coverage of the issue was so scant and so insufficient. I do want to give kudos to Kevin Fagan from San Francisco Chronicle, who was one of the few reporters that dug below the surface and actually got it right. And also the LA Times did a great endorsement. But the rest of the reporting was so scant that it really did a disservice to the issue and ultimately to the tribe, and it allowed the opposition to come in with about $20 million of campaign financing and advertising and really squash the issue.
Well, thank you for calling in, Charlie, and I'll definitely add this to our list. Thanks for calling. I just looked at the clock. We're almost out of time. And, David, I want to ask you, Okay, let's talk about the economy first, because what we're seeing now in the headlines is that the economy's back, lower unemployment, we've got record high stocks. And NPR did touch on this morning, that average earnings have not risen in more than 6 years. The wealth gap continues to rise. You've written extensively about this. You've got a new piece right now about Christina Romer, President Obama's former economic advisor, who's now kind of sort of speaking out about the policies the president took. And she's basically saying that they're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, there's a paper that Christina and her husband, David Romer, who are both at the University of Cal Berkeley now, did. And it was responding to this idea that after a financial crisis, that you can always expect recessions to be long and severe. That was the theory that was put out by Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff, and picked up by the media, picked up by the policymakers, basically saying that this was inevitable. We had a huge financial crisis, and it just takes a long time to come back from that. What Romer and Romer did was they looked at a series of financial crises from 1967 to 2007 in advanced countries who have tools to deal with recessions and protracted downturns, and what they found is that it was not inevitable, that the policy response mattered, that it was highly variable whether or not you would have a long recession or a short and very transitory recession, and that overall the effect from a financial crisis was very modest and somewhat temporary. So that information, I think, is critical to judging the policy response that was done in the wake of our financial crisis in 2008. I feel like this idea that nothing can be done was used as a crutch to sort of say, okay, we'll try a little bit of fiscal policy here, a little bit there, but, you know, we did the best we could. It was a way, an excuse that policymakers made so they didn't have to actually reckon with the failure of their own policies. And Christina Romer, who did work in the Obama White House, is the head of the Council for Economic Advisors, is kind of blowing the whistle on that. And it should inform how we judge politicians. It should inform how they conduct policy in advance of the next crisis, in addition to after the next crisis. And it should allow us to have an informed opinion about what is going on in the country, and how the economic kind of slowness that we've felt over the last several years isn't inevitable. It's a choice. It's a policy choice made by people who don't want to push any further on elites or people with a lot of money in order to rebalance the economy.
What do you make of the headlines we're seeing about the bouncing back economy, low unemployment, et cetera? Sure. What do the numbers actually tell us? Because we're getting these numbers that say jobs are being created, but we rarely hear about the fact that these are low-paying jobs with no benefits. Often people are working 2 to 3 jobs just to make ends meet.
Well, you hit it right there. I mean, the quality of jobs that have come back since the recession are not good. What we've seen by another Berkeley economist, Emmanuel Saiz, he put out a recent report with Gabriel Zucman that shows that the benefits, almost all of the gains since the crisis, I'd say 90-95%, I believe, was in their paper, have gone to the very top, the top 1%. And the stock market isn't the economy, and a bigger stock market does not necessarily reflect what is going on to people at the ground level, where wages have been stagnant arguably since 1979, and where the quality of jobs are not good, insecurity is still fairly high, job security is fairly low, and inequality continues to soar throughout the country. So I would say that, and I think that this fact, this inescapable fact, I mean, the exit polls showed that voters believe 2-1 that the wealthy, the system of the economy is built for the wealthy,
2-1, and then 70% said the economy is poor at this point. And I think you can't sort of, with numbers and statistics that you want to use, sort of will people into thinking that their personal economic fortunes are better than they are, because they're not. And we need to come to terms with that and create an agenda that would turn that around.
And David, what are you working on right now?
Well, I'm working on a couple stories. I just went to a fascinating policy breakfast about deferred prosecution agreements. Now, these are things that the Justice Department enters into with corporations that allow them, instead of when there is corporate crime, instead of either prosecuting or declining to prosecute, they do this middle ground thing, this deferred prosecution agreement, where they get some sort of slap on the wrist settlement and then agree not to prosecute at this time but reserve the right to later. But, of course, that never happens. So what's interesting is that deferred prosecution agreements were initially put in place for juvenile first-time offenders at the turn of the last century. I mean, this is what they were built for, that, you know, maybe we don't want a first-time offender to have something on their record when they're very young, and so we'll have this deferred prosecution agreement and rehabilitate them. But now they're being used for corporations, which is absolutely crazy, and it's really shot up in use over the last 20 years, and so... There's a paper that's coming out about that.
Well, wow. Thank you so much for your reporting, and we'll definitely look for that. David Diane writes for Salon and the Fiscal Times. And Brad, thank you so much for your reporting about voter ID and no paper ballots and on and on. Brad Friedman runs the Brad blog. Thank you both for joining us.
Always my pleasure. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What's in store for the future of food labeling and GMOs? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Professor Sheldon Krimsky, co-editor of the book The GMO Deception, What You Need to Know About the Food, Corporations, and Government Agencies Putting Our Families and Our Environment at Risk. GMO labeling measures went down in Colorado and Oregon. What explains those defeats? And what does the science tell us about GMO safety? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.